Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. Sorry for the delay, but thank you all for finding your way here this morning for the final roundtable of the 2014-2015 season. We'll resume again in September, I presume, and you'll be hearing about that. As you know, for the past couple of months, we have been marking the 50th anniversary of Thursday Morning Roundtable with a series of programs that have mirrored some of the speakers that we had back then. On April 29th of 1965, Clark Ahlberg, who was a senior vice president for administration at the university, was the speaker, and he spoke on the topic of the university and the community. Now, we don't know what he said. We don't have any record of that meeting, but it was a time of expansion for the university, so we can guess that maybe he was talking about some of the developments on campus and off campus as the university grew and expanded into the community. But one thing we do know is that through University College in particular, Syracuse University has always been involved in adult education. And actually, that is where Thursday Morning Roundtable came from, out of adult education. And at the time it was conceived, Dr. Alex Charters, who I don't think is here this morning, he's on his way up. Well, Dr. Charters was the dean of University College, and in 1964, he was actually promoted to be vice president for continuing education. And that was a pretty big step for continuing education or adult education. And it included not just extension courses, but a whole slew of activities at that time. Dr. Charters, of course, then is a charter member of the Thursday Morning Roundtable. So... And we will be, there he is. We will be continuing, actually, our celebration of the 50th anniversary when we come back in the fall. You might have noticed and just wanted to make a quick announcement about an event that we have coming up planned for the fall. You might have heard yesterday or the day before that the university has announced its university lecture series lineup for next year. In October, there are going to be two speakers at the university lecture having a conversation about income inequality. And those are two New York Times columnists, Charles Blow and Ross Douthat. There you go. Anyway, fortunately, it is Charles Blow, because I think I can pronounce his name more easily, who will be joining us on Wednesday, October 13th, for a Thursday Morning Roundtable special fundraising breakfast event. It will be an event that will be raising funds for the Levi L. Smith Scholarship Fund, which was started 25 years ago, guess what, in honor of TMR's 25th anniversary. So you'll be hearing more about that. It will take a little bit of an adjustment because it will be a Wednesday morning, but we will be having a special event with a special guest speaker who will be having actually be taking questions from you as well about the university lecture the night before. So that will be an exciting event in October. Wanted to let you know about that. So now our annual, I've lost count, Dr. Rubin, but annual meeting with the Ivory Tower half-hour panel. Their special one-hour program, except, again, in honor of our 50th anniversary, I asked them if they would adjust their conversation a little bit to talk about the issue of the university and the community, given that we represent a number of educational institutions here, and they very kindly agreed to do that. So I'm going to turn it over to David Rumid, Dean Emeritus and Professor at the Newhouse School of Syracuse University, and thank you all for being here this morning.
Thank you, Sandra. It's always a pleasure to be with such an intelligent audience. And I know many of you watch the show. We appreciate that very much. This will be quite different from what we usually do. It's not going to look like the show or sound like the show. We're not going to talk about Baltimore. That'll be tomorrow night and various other subjects. What I'm going to do is have each of the panelists briefly discuss this question from his or her own perspective, Tim comes from a pretty wealthy private school in a very small town. Then Tim Burns, then Bob Green comes from a not so wealthy private school in a small town. Then Tara Ross, who is at a community college with a rather different mission from this town. And then Lisa from a very large school in this town. And I'll follow Lisa with a few remarks also about SU and its relationship. And I've asked each of the panelists to keep remarks to 5 minutes or less, because I have a sense that the question and answer part of this will be more valuable, probably, than what we may say. So think about what you want to ask, and we'll go from there. Let me just say in advance that Tim may have to leave a couple minutes before this ends, because he has to drive to Colgate for an important meeting as his Department of Political Science implodes. Largely because he's the chair. Yeah.
David said, "Who's the chair?" And I said, "I am." There you go.
So with that as an introduction, why don't you tell us about Colgate's relationship to its city?
Okay, city.
Town. Village.
We have a joke. We say downtown Hamilton as if there's an uptown. I was thinking, as you were saying, David, that Colgate, a wealthy liberal arts college in Hamilton, and then Casanova, not so wealthy liberal arts college, but in a wealthy town, and that makes a big difference. There is a Casanova, New York, without Casanova College. Colgate's relationship with Hamilton is kind of completely symbiotic in a way, and therefore very complicated. I'd like to say just a few things very quickly. I'll sort of list them, and then we can either talk about them among ourselves, question and answer. But there are a few issues. The first is that the university has to be responsive to the lives of the people who live there. Colgate has about 3,000 students, and we limit those who can live in the village to about 300. So you have to apply as a senior to be able to live in the village, because when you sprinkle 300 21-year-olds in a village of 3,000, we like to say the peacetime population is 3,000, and the students are about the same. And I've also told myself, I don't live in the village anymore, but I did for about 10 years. And I used to say to the students all the time, you know, you give me 3 or 4 beers, I speak louder also. But when you have something like 500 people walking past your house Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night who've had at least that much alcohol, it's a very problematic situation. So there's always a kind of a give and take about how much responsibility the university has to control the behavior of these residents who happen to be 21 years old and have nothing to do on a Thursday night but, you know, enjoy themselves. The second, however, is the commercial life of the village. Colgate has a very great interest in the commercial life of the village, because 2 or 3 times a year, the suburban parents who fund this wealthy liberal arts college show up in town. And they want it to be a vibrant village. But they're only there a few days a year. So, you know, we like to say Hamilton's not Williamstown, but it's not Oriskany Falls either. And so I hope I'm not insulting any people from Oriskany Falls. But the problem is that Colgate has plenty of money. Colgate can run businesses without making a profit. And yet we need to have the profit-generating businesses in town feel that they are being enhanced by Colgate's presence rather than superseded by it. I'm not involved in those discussions, but I know they're ongoing and they are sometimes quite tense. So Colgate opened a coffee shop some years ago, and there are actually detailed discussions about what sorts of sandwiches Colgate would serve, because 3 doors down is a sandwich shop being run by people who've been there for years and don't want their business being put out of business. But imagine in any community you lived that there was one institutional player who could run commercial enterprises without needing to make a profit. That's problematic. On the other hand, the other businesses benefit from Colgate's participation in the community in a commercial way. At the moment, Colgate moved its bookstore into the village, which is terrific. They opened a coffee shop, which has now been franchised. They opened a nightclub, and they have at least one restaurant. And this is it's a complicated issue. Another one is that Colgate feels responsible to the community to keep the community alive for people like yourselves. We have a lot of people who live in Hamilton who are not 21 years old, who may not be on the faculty of Colgate, and Colgate's responsibility is to provide that community with an intellectually stimulating environment. I think Colgate does a very good job of that, actually. There's a lot of speakers, music. Colgate runs a lot of festivals in the summer. We have writers' conferences where people are invited in to talk to rather prominent writers. So there's a sort of what is Colgate's role in the intellectual life of the village. And then finally, Colgate runs something called the Upstate Institute, which is a way of encouraging faculty and students to do socially responsible research about our area. And so both can apply to the university for grants if they want to do research that would be useful. This is a huge question in current higher education, what our responsibility is. We do research. I like to say I write books that nobody reads, and it's pretty close to the truth. But the university as a whole feels that it ought to be encouraging academic and scholarly work that would actually have a value to the people who live around us. And if you've never been to Colgate, I invite you to drive down to our beautiful village on a day like today. Colgate is a jewel sitting within a relatively underdeveloped part of Madison County going into Shenango Valley. So there's a lot of poverty and other social difficulties right around us. And Colgate tries not to put the gate up too high in these ways. Sorry if that was too long, but there's a lot going on about this issue. Yeah.
Colgate. All right, so let's move to Casanova.
I'd move to Casanova if I could afford it. I don't live in the village. I live in Chittenango. I write books that people read. My most recent one is being sold on Amazon by advance order right now. Tim's right. This is a big ticket question that is not just something that interests the Chamber of Commerce's that affect our specific areas, but affect every part of student life. We have people here in the room who have been on our Board of Trustees, who have been on our administrative staff, who have dealt with these issues for a number of years. Before I get to my list, just to play off some of the things that Tim brought up, the students in the village and the interaction of the students in the village of Casanova has, of course, been a huge issue as long as I've been there. I've been there 35 years. One of the things that we have done to deal with this issue is to give students scholarships that keeps them on campus. There are many of the scholarships that we give out now are presidential scholarships that say that you forfeit your scholarship unless you live in the dormitories. And that's becoming more and more the norm. In terms of community life, where I think it's different for us and Hamilton is that the number one influx of income in the village of Casanova is not the students of Casanova or the institution of Casanova College, it's tourism. And in that way, you say you're not like a Riskany Falls, people in Casanova see more of a symbiosis, I think, with Skinny Atlas. And the tourism influx, and we have to play off of that in the summer. Anything that we want to do in the summer has to be really meshed very well with all of the tourism opportunities in the village of Casanova. But I saw a couple of things that I want to bring up that Tim didn't mention. The first is building. You say, go to Hamilton on a beautiful day. Come to Casanova and try to find the college. I dare you. I mean, we don't have a front door. We're surrounded by businesses, and we are smack dab in the middle of a residential neighborhood, which makes our relationship with those residents tense at times and interesting all the times. I mean, we're literally landlocked. And so when we want to expand, it's not a question of money. It's a question of territory. It's a question of space. Where are we going to put the new art and design building? Where would we put a new dormitory, even if we had the money for it? And so that relationship, there was a time when we tried to solve the relationship by buying up homes all the way around the perimeter of the college. And that, of course, it solved some problems. It made us, in many people's minds, very quaint, very English. We had the white clapboard houses with offices in it, but of course we were planting our offices right in residential neighborhoods. And that caused some trouble too. So in terms of the expansion that you would want, building codes by the village. I just spent some time down, and a lot of time actually, down in College Station, Texas A&M University, researching this wonderful book that you should go on Amazon and all buy. There's a law in College Station that says that if you have a business that faces one of the main streets, part of the face of your business has to be painted in maroon and black. So when you go into the village of, or the city of College Station, you feel that everything is the campus. Now that's of course not the case in Hamilton, that's not the case in Casanova, and you don't see, except possibly on Marshall Street, the same thing here. And so in terms of building codes, that's a big issue, which gets me into athletics. I think that athletics plays such a huge role, and my colleagues here at larger institutions may want to talk about that, but that certainly affects the town-gown relationship. We've seen that happen with the Syracuse University relationship for years. And the last thing that I want to mention is minority students. Bringing minority students and students from the city, New York City, into an environment like the village of Casanova, we might as well be putting them on the moon. We know that. We have had to take and have special programs to acclimate students from big cities coming into small towns. It doesn't, and then one wonders whether it should be the other way around. Should we be acclimating the village to those students? It's a two-way educational street, as far as I'm concerned, because I think both can benefit from each other. But the interesting part about this, and then I'll close, is that PR types try to make this issue disappear. They try to make it look like everything is wonderful between the schools and the town gown. There's no tension, no nothing. We all coexist. It's just simply not true, but that there's an excitement in the tension in town gown relationships that makes for a vibrant college if you channel it correctly and if you use it correctly. I'm done.
Okay. Now to OCC, Tara Ross, floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, of course, I'm the one person at the table who has community in her college's name. And that really is a reflection of how community colleges were begun, because community colleges were developed to address the needs of people in the community that were not being addressed by four-year institutions, certainly not by private four-year institutions, and to a certain extent even by public four-year institutions. And I bring this up because many people don't really know that that's sort of the tension that we sort of live with at community colleges. Because part of how community colleges get started is to address the educational needs of GIs. For example, community colleges really begin to proliferate in the 1960s and early 1970s as GIs are coming back from the Vietnam War, to address the needs of the changing society as we begin to move from industrial to more technical and then obviously computerized, to address the needs of a growing number of women who were, you know, either children were grown and they wanted to go back to school, but they couldn't afford to go to four-year institutions or didn't feel comfortable because, you know, obviously at most four-year institutions at that time period, you still had the majority of your population being between the ages of 18 and 22 or 23, and if there was a grad school, maybe 25. And so we were developed to address all of those other needs. And, you know, I think we do a wonderful job at it. But even for us, there is sort of a growing tension in terms of how much a part of the community we are and exactly how much of our programming should address the needs of the community and also what we need to do to remain vibrant and competitive, you know, both with other community colleges as those have proliferated, with our four-year colleagues. So we have that sort of ongoing tension. And one of the things that we, you know, used to do a great deal more than we do is we used to provide continuing education in terms of what I would call sort of special interest type courses. That used to be a major component of what OCC provided along with obviously our regular classes. And increasingly, we have begun to focus more on meeting the business-oriented needs of the community and less on meeting sort of the special interests. So, for example, you know, maybe you wanted to take a course where you learned how to use herbs to, you know, for better health. There was a time when you would have that sort of a course that you could take on a regular basis at OCC in the evening. The reality is that we no longer generally teach those types of courses. BOCES now teaches most of those types of courses. And so, you know, that created some tension because there were people in the community who felt like, well, this is part of what they are to do. You should be doing that as well as teaching your regular daytime classes to, you know, low-income students, et cetera. And quite frankly, we, you know, had to make the decision that because we need to stay economically profitable, it was not as profitable for us to do those sorts of things. Community colleges also do some other things, too, in that they also provide a place where individuals who, for whatever reasons, either don't feel that they fit at a four-year institution right away or perhaps didn't fit at a four-year institution but still want to get an education, we provide that opportunity for them. And so we really are sort of within the heart of the community, and we take the community sort of as it is. But now the flip side of that is that as the educational field has changed and as there's become much more pressure on colleges and universities at all levels to be self-sustaining, we've really had to look at how we maintain our profitability and still meet our mission. And the best example for us has been the building of our stadiums. We have stadiums for our award-winning sports teams, and that created some consternation within the community up on Onondaga Hill because, of course, you know, there was first the construction, which made life very interesting for people who lived up on the hill. And they were very concerned when we built dorms. That made life very interesting, again, the construction. But also, when you build dorms, you have students, and students come with cars. Students come with noise, you know. And all of that is now a part of the life of people up on Onondaga Hill. And, you know, certainly some of those individuals who live up on Onondaga Hill lived up there when it was just farmland. So this has meant a major change for them. And so our constant struggle is, how do we maintain what is our mission? How do we remain a good neighbor, but also how do we remain profitable?
Okay. Lisa Dolak is next. Most of you know her because I've introduced her this way for 8 years on the show. As a professor at the College of Law, which she still is, but she has a new job, which is the interim liaison between the Board of Trustees at the university and the Chancellor. So she is now so well positioned that she probably feels constrained to say anything at all.
Either that or we're going to hear everything that's good.
Knowing Lisa, I would doubt that. So. At any rate, Lisa, whatever you feel comfortable saying now, you should say.
Do you see people all take out their phones now and are recording all of this?
Yeah, I would say good morning and have a nice day. No, well, in all seriousness, though, of course, my university and my town face some version of most of the issues that my colleagues have mentioned to some greater or lesser extent. And I for many reasons, won't repeat discussion of those, but including because I know that Dean Rubin has a great deal to say on this subject. And so we're all looking forward to hearing that.
Go figure.
So I'll just say that it has always struck me, I'm finishing my 20th year at Syracuse University. And it has always struck me that it's the kind of the nature of conversation, nature of media coverage, that I think too often the conversation about town-gown relations is framed by the areas of friction, whether it be, you know, the taxes that the universities don't pay or the students that live in the surrounding neighborhoods or whatever it is. I guess I would like to see greater acknowledgement of the tremendous mutual benefit that that schools and their surrounding surrounds experience. And I think that we don't see enough of that. I often have thought, I sort of shudder to think what Syracuse would look like without Syracuse University, and what, of course, Syracuse University would do without how it would get along without the, enormous infrastructure support that the city of Syracuse and the community provides. I just don't think we don't hear about that enough. I also think that there's a lot of individual student or small groups of students working in the community in various ways, whether it be internships or educational projects. And same with what's going on between the faculty and the communities. And it doesn't get highlighted. I also think there's not enough of it. I would love to see even greater advantage taken by universities of the educational opportunities that exist in their communities, the real-world education that community work can foster. And the same goes for the faculty. I think there is a perception, as we know, that faculty are too ivory tower and too disconnected from reality. And for some, that probably is true. But I think that's not true as to the extent that the perception is. I mean, I think that if we understood how much real-world impact faculty have, whether it's through their research, but also just through their partnerships, their work, their consulting work, for example, paid and unpaid in the community, I think we would be going a long way toward building a better relationship. So I guess my point is that I believe that there is the potential for even greater collaboration for the benefit of individual students, businesses, the community. And there's also the potential for highlighting that and for spending more time looking at it.
Okay. So let me add a couple thoughts about SU, particularly because, as I assume all of you in here know, for Chancellor Cantor, town-gown relations were at the center of her chancellorship. And so I want to really address what she attempted to do and from my perspective, what she was able to accomplish or not accomplish. First, I think it's clear from what everyone here has said that any college or university that ignores the town-gown relationship does so at its peril. And certainly SU has not, including the Buzz Shaw era when I was also here. And I've seen SU have a pretty strong moral commitment to the neighborhoods around SU to try to keep them stable, to try not to allow students to take them over, to attempt to help young faculty buy houses in the area, to attempt to keep families there so that it doesn't turn into a student-only area. It's a very difficult struggle because landlords find students profitable. And they are, and so they can afford to buy up houses that young faculty can't. So I don't really blame the university for not being able to do this even better, because it's a very hard thing to do. But I know that both Chancellor Shaw and Cantor were concerned about that. Also, I agree with Lisa that both chancellors made it a priority to get SU students into the community. I actually think they've done an even better job than perhaps Lisa implied. We have students from the School of Education are teaching all over the area. We have architecture students who are working to design livable housing, inexpensive housing, places perhaps to house homeless. The Newhouse School has been helping businesses with advertising and public relations campaigns. VPA sends its students around to perform for free for various populations in the city. Lisa's Law School runs clinics. Bill Copeland, Professor Copeland at Arts and Sciences, has an entire major devoted to having students work in the community. So I really think Syracuse has done a very good job of getting students into the community. I think Chancellor Cantor was, again to pick up on Lisa, was quite right to worry about the effect of a deteriorating city on the health of the university. I think she was right to say that if Syracuse becomes, say, Amsterdam, New York, then the university cannot be as great as it needs to be. If Syracuse as the city goes down, we go down. So she was right, I think, to focus on how to help Syracuse become a better place. And when she arrived, I think she was fortunate in a couple of ways. One, the city at that time, in my view, this will probably be controversial, so push back. If Matt Driscoll was here, it'd be definitely controversial. That the city didn't have much of a vision for itself as to what it wanted to do. It also didn't have any money. It still doesn't have any money. We're not Charlotte, North Carolina, for example, where you have money and you have a big banking sector that helped propel that city forward. We don't have that. So she came into a political vacuum and a planning vacuum, and she had plans and she had money. And so the political leadership, both in the city and the county, particularly the city, embraced that and said, well, she's got something going, so let's give it a try. So the question then is the city better for the kinds of things that she attempted to do? And this is worth a book, I think, if someone wanted to write it. There you go, Bob. There's another
book. Yeah, I got plenty of time.
So let me just tick off a couple of things to give you my perspective on this. I mean, the larger question is downtown better for her efforts or not? And is the city in general better for her efforts? Was her vision of a connective corridor a wise one? Has it worked out pretty well? So here's my view on that. I think that putting students forcibly downtown at the warehouse was a good idea because it did help to grow out the Armory Square area, which is clearly the most vibrant part of downtown, and it is growing out. It is a lot better than it was 10 years ago, for sure. And she and the university are not responsible for all of that. I greatly admire a guy like Bob Doucette, who I think is responsible for a lot of that. But I think the warehouse was a smart idea. It was expensive for us. It hasn't been used as a building to its capacity. Running a shuttle bus service is not cheap in order to get students up and down. But if we look, say, 20 years ahead, and if, say, 81 comes down, which it's beginning to look like it might, and then if the university starts to look for other places to creep into the city, then I think we'll see the warehouse as having been the beginning of that. And I personally think that it would be healthy for the city to have more students and faculty downtown regularly so that there's a regular exchange back and forth. I mean, you need a mass of people downtown if you want to have more restaurants and stores and a supermarket and so on. I mean, Whole Foods is not coming down there yet, so you need more people. Then she wanted to try to revive the Near West Side. Here's where I think, I mean, how to phrase this. I mean, this is the Lord's work. I mean, it's such a poor area. And as I say, the city has no money. And should a university attempt a heavy lift like that? I give her a lot of credit for trying, number one. I give her a lot of credit for some success. She was instrumental in convincing WCNY to build its new headquarters down there, which has made a big difference. And just so you know, I'm on the board of WCNY, so I was involved in that. And I think that's helped. King & King is there. The Literacy Center moved its headquarters there. The university helped convince them to do that. There are little arts outposts on the near west side. Some of the housing is better. So, is the area physically better? Yes. Has it become better for its residents? I don't know. Is it even within the ability of a university to make that happen? Maybe a Harvard, a Columbia with those kinds of resources? SU? I don't know. And then, and this you might want to debate, is this even the role of a university to take on something that big and also that removed from our campus? Because it's not as if it's next door to us. It isn't. I mean, the warehouse part is next door, but the main campus isn't. So that, to me, is controversial. The connective corridor was meant to try to knit the city together and use the arts to do it. And here I think that was, again, I'm a big arts lover, as many of you know, as was she, and I applauded that idea when I heard it, but there's a couple problems with it. One, the arts community is far more fragile than I think she knew, and is still today. And so she was trying to knit together institutions that themselves are barely hanging on. Two, this isn't a walking community. And I don't see, because of the weather, that it is ever going to be. So that the notion of creating some kind of corridor like that, to me, never made very much sense. And so it's largely just a bus route. And I haven't seen that it has in any way really helped the arts or helped to define the city. But I give her credit for giving it the old college try, as it were. What I think things have been perhaps most problematic is I'm very uncomfortable with a university calling the shots on city streets. That is, streets that become two-way that had been one-way, streets that get expanded or contracted, all the construction that has occurred on University and Genesee. There, I think, when a university reaches that far into how a city is being built, we've gone too far. And I'd have to say, just looking at University, which is now two-way instead of one-way, it's got bike paths. Nobody's using those bike paths. It's now more dangerous to cross it. You have to walk, look both ways. I've practically been killed 15 times. It seems to have been a lot of money spent, which I wish we could have spent fixing, say, water pipes. But a lot of money spent on infrastructure, and I don't see that it was called for, necessary. I don't see the vision there. So if there was one big problem, I would say that was it. So this has been an enormous undertaking. The bottom line, I think she accomplished many things. I think it fell short in many ways. But I think where it hurt the most, and this is my last point, no chancellor can, in my view, ever put town before gown. It's always has to first be about gown. That's why you were hired. And so that means you've got to stick to your knitting at home. That is, the quality of the education has to be really good. The students and the faculty have to feel that they are the most important thing for the chancellor. You really have to put a lot of your energy into fundraising for local things. And in the end, I think one of the reasons that she left was the sense that the town had gotten preeminence over the gown. And in the process, the university, while the city itself did improve some because of her efforts, the university, arguably, I would say here, did not. And so when that happens, I don't think any chancellor can survive that. So that's my two cents on town gown under Chancellor Cantor. And I'd be curious now if anybody on the panel wants to say anything in relation to what any of us said, or shall I open it to questions? Tim? Tara? Bob?
Rather Lisa? Questions.
I'm ready for questions.
You're ready. Well, I just want to comment. Okay. I think one of the points you raise about whether the city is better versus whether SU is better is interesting, because part of this question is always, the question is always from the university perspective. We rarely ask mm-hmm. it from the community's mm-hmm. perspective. And I really think that what she did, whether you agree with it or not, really did help SU's image within the community, because I think most people in the community, especially in the communities immediately around SU, really did see it as the ivory tower and did have a sense that the people in that tower thought that they were better. And I think her actions began to change that somewhat. I really do.
I think you bring up a really good point. It's perception becomes reality. The town, does it feel that it is being treated as a partner with the college, with the university, with the community college? Does it feel that it is left out? Has it been have you visited Chamber of Commerce meetings? Have you gone to the planning meetings? Have you had the mayor over for lunch? Have you reached out to the village or to the town or to the city itself? The relationship between Nancy Cantor and Matt Driscoll, the relationship between Nancy Cantor and Joni Mahoney, the relationship between the presidents of our colleges and the mayors and the school boards, particularly the school boards in small towns, even more so than mayors' offices reaching out to school boards. Do they feel that they are a part of the town, whether or not the infrastructure follows, but do they feel good about the relationship? I've seen relationships, perception be good, where the reality may not be so good and things are placid, things are fine. You talk about concentrating on the negatives. Sometimes the negatives don't look like negatives when people believe that they're a part of the solution. So it's a lot of politics and being able to reach out and make people feel like they are a part of the ivory tower, like they're a part of the community.
Yeah, I accept what you say. I think that she did make the city feel better about the institution, and I accept that that's important. All right, there was a question.
Okay, I'll be coming around. Bear with me. I have just one microphone, and I'll try to catch your hands. I did see a hand up over here, and if you could, wouldn't mind standing.
Yes, in regards to town and gown, it's clear that everybody, no matter what level of institution is out there, that there has to be a relationship between the town and the gown community. My focus is on the OCC in particular, and how I had a sense that there was a lot of activity to tailor course material to a lot of particular companies that needed certain type of training for their folks. I guess my question goes to the larger, the SUs versus some of the smaller colleges. Is that something that every college feels there's a value to the community, obviously, as well as to the school to do that? Or is it just more the community college, like that's your mission, more than the rest of your counterparts?
Yeah.
Well, certainly, I'll only speak for the community college. Certainly, it is a part of our mission, and it's part of a constant tension that we have on the campus. And I've done research in the history of the college, and it's been a part of the campus life, and that tension's been there literally since we were developed, because there's always been this question, what is your chief focus? Is it to provide students who can't afford it, a four-year institution, whether private or public, with that basic, you know, foundation to then transfer to one of the 4 years? Or is it to provide more of the technical, I'm careful not to use vocational because, of course, we've moved away from that world. Is it to provide more of the technical, more practical skills that a person needs so that they can get a job right away? So for us, that's just a part of our daily lives. Now, what I can't speak to, and I think if I understand your question, you were really asking, is that also a part of the daily life of the 4 years?
What are you looking at me for?
All of you four.
Actually,
you folks.
Actually, one area that I would add to this, Casanova does not have particular majors, fields, or courses. Where's the gentleman? He's right back there. That play to donors, that play to people who are, you know, important in the life of the college. What we do have is a very vibrant internship program. And you reach out into the city of Syracuse, into the state of New York, as far as D.C. and over to London with internships, and you play a role that way. And internships are not the wave of the future. They were the wave of the future 20 years ago and are just as important today as they were then. I think that anybody who is running continuing ed, and we have someone in the room who literally created Casanova College's continuing ed program out of whole cloth, you have to look at what the businesses want as well as what the ivory tower wants and what's legitimate and find a good balance there. You know, we are not there to just, you know, to shill for the businesses of Casanova any more than my colleagues are Syracuse or The Hill or Hamilton. If you can find that balance, you've got a really good continuing ed person.
Yeah, I guess I would have to add that from the continuing ed perspective, University College over the years has tried to do that. I've only been around for 20 years. We used to have business and professional training. Before that, there were a lot of things. Now we have the TED Center, which is talent and education development, which tries to do things for local, not just the employers, but employees. And we also have our own, we being University College, degree program, a Bachelor of Professional Studies that tries, again, for local people in local jobs, trying to tailor that. So there's a little bit about that. There are two questions here.
You've been tiptoeing around one of the areas that I've found, and I've been on the board of Casanova College since 1985, Bob knows. When you're in the community, every time you buy another house or expand, you take things off the tax rolls. And the powers that be in the community are saying, well, you use the fire department, you use the police department, the ambulance, and you pay us nothing. And then you take more tax dollars away from us. And I'd be very interested in knowing if that's true with SU, with Colgate, et cetera. You have all those benefits, but from the other side of that negotiating table, the politicians are saying you're not paying your fair share.
Yeah, Charles, you and I have talked about this for years. And I think that the solution to this from a small college point of view, and I'd be interested to know if you agree with me on this, is in education of the village in terms of what the college can give you for taking those tax dollars away from the tax base. It's interesting when you decide that you're going to buy rather than expand, since we can't build, we have to expand by purchase, and you take it off the tax dollars. You have to have a leader in the administrative office who can look at the village and say, yeah, we're taking this money away from you, but here's what you get for it. You know, we're not going to give you that money back. And any kind of a small donation, I think, to a fire department or to an ambulance service is just that, not enough to cover. But you have to say, look, we are partners in this, and make them believe or feel that they're actually getting something for what is really an investment when you stop and look at it that way. But it's really tough because the perception is you're stealing money. You're taking money away.
Yeah, Colgate is by, I mean, David asked me to comment. Colgate is by and large a self-contained entity. so there's the village of Hamilton, and then you drive onto Colgate's campus, and there it is. I mentioned that Colgate runs a few businesses in town. I frankly don't know what the tax status of those are. I can't believe you have a tax-exempt coffee shop, but I don't know what that is. I assume that they're treated as other businesses in the village. But I would say this, which is, I'm not always good at putting things politely. The relationship between Hamilton and Colgate, as I said before, is symbiotic in the sense that if Colgate isn't there, Hamilton is just an entirely 100% completely existentially different place. And so that is kind of the baseline of all of these discussions. And I'm not in the room when they have the discussions, and Colgate's not going anywhere, right? So it's not like they can threaten. But it is the central agent, actor, presence of the village. And all of those relationships, I think, are based on that simple fact. And also in terms of fire service and stuff like that, I don't know the percentages, but a very high percentage of the firefighters in Hamilton, New York are Colgate students. It's a big deal. Students love it.
They do EMT training.
And we actually, you know, I said Colgate is what Dan Quayle thinks America looks like. We actually, you sit in class and they actually have a fire whistle goes off. And a couple of students will stand up and run out and save the cat and then come back to class.
I would just add that Mayor Miner has made an effort to get the nonprofits in Syracuse to make regular yearly contributions to the city. I think, didn't Syracuse University agree to make a payment?
Yeah.
$500,000 a year. My prediction is that that sort of thing will continue and grow because it has to, because if the money is in the universities and not in the cities, but the cities have to provide services, there's no way out of this. And so I think it's the appropriate thing to do, that SU should pay and Harvard should pay Cambridge and Yale has done a lot in New Haven, and that's the way it should be.
I have to go. I just want to say how nice it is to speak to an audience who knows who Dan Quayle is.
Thank you, Tim.
Well, thanks so much, Senator, for letting me ask this question, because I feel really strongly about it, and I'm going to try and keep my temper. This is probably for Professor Dolak, the liaison to the chancellor. But others can comment on it, too. Bicycle season is starting. I'm a cyclist, and I can't tell you how frustrating it is to ride up University Ave and come to that blockage, the fence. I think it's still there. It was a few days ago. Now, you know, that throws bicyclists right out into University Ave, which is not as safe as it used to be. And there's really nowhere to go except right out in the street, in the wrong lane of traffic. Now, I know there's a business issue. There may be litigation. You know, it's a complex issue involving finance and construction, stalled construction. But to me, that symbolizes the disconnect in the corridor. It symbolizes a retreat. I mean, if you're going to give something to the community, don't take it back a year later. Don't destroy the bike lane. I think there are bicyclists who use it besides me. And more people are. There's more and more interest in cycling as an alternative. But symbolically, this just looks like a turnaround. And I suppose a second question, if you want to address that, or this too, does this really mean that the current chancellor is not invested in maintaining that relationship with Syracuse and its bicyclists and its residents?
I'm certainly not in a position to speak on behalf of the university. I participate in this program as my own views, so I can't address the question on behalf of the university. I don't think it's anybody's desire that situation continue for, so it's not desired to be a permanent situation by anyone, I don't believe.
And it might be a question, actually, that we would want to ask the city's transportation department. I don't know either. I'm not speaking for the university or the city, but just that it is a public street. It isn't as far as I know, the university doesn't own University Ave, and it seems to me the city should have something to say about it. So
it would seem to me that it's litigation. We can't talk about it.
Right.
But as far as being blocking a city street. Anyway, let's have another question.
For years, there's been a discussion, particularly by community leaders, of how do we retain the talent of students graduating from the various institutions in this community. I'm in public affairs. We place over 100 students every semester in various projects, partly classroom projects, as well as working with nonprofits and educational institutions and governments. The way to attract students or to keep students here is we have to find a mechanism to keep them here in the summer. This year, I've been able to place 2 students in paid internships. That's it, 2 students. My experience in the past has been we get maybe 2 or 3 placements. Usually those students, I would say at least one of them, will stay when offered a job. They are always amazed at how different Syracuse is from May to September compared to September to May, right. It opens up a whole new experience for them. It makes them interested in staying in Syracuse. I think we have to figure out a mechanism that if people really want our talent to stay here, we have to find a way to keep them here in the summer. They pay for apartments starting in June for 11 months. So there's an incentive for them to stay if they are living in an apartment.
I would just say, as the mother of two children who, for whom, well, one of them went to school here, and I paid those 12-month leases for her, mm-hmm. even though she, one of them was in right around the corner from my house in the university neighborhood. So I was paying the mortgage on my house and the rent on the house three doors down. But both of them have left. They both, they won't be back in Syracuse. This is a question of the economic vitality of the community.
Yeah, and I've got a similar story. I paid rent on a apartment or a home or a home for wayward children in Queens, New York, when my son was down at St. John's. And I think you're absolutely correct, and the data does show this. I've seen some of it, where if you can keep students year-round, they are more likely to maintain permanent residence in their college town. I think there's an awful lot to be said for paid internships in the Syracuse area. But my son is now living in New York, never desired to leave New York City and come back here, but I know that it was because not of a great desire to get out of Dodge and move down there, but he was offered an advantage over the summer that turned into a full-time job. And it was one of those, I just can't refuse this, Dad. So can you give me a little more money for rent? And I don't know about you, but it's a never-ending cycle.
Yeah, I'm still paying now. I'm still paying her rent.
Hey, they got full-time jobs and they still need money.
At least they're not living in your basement. Let me say that we do have comebackers. We have a couple. We have a couple in the room right now. I'm looking at them over here. So there is hope. I also want to say, as somebody who was a Newhouse student, took a summer course with Jay Cox, so that was a while ago, right? Did an internship with the Syracuse Hill Urban Renewal Advisory Committee. That was a long time ago. But someone from a smaller city, and so I don't think we can necessarily expect our children to stay here right away, but maybe they will come back. And so I think that's something else for someone who maybe comes from Amsterdam or Oriskany Falls or Hamilton. Syracuse is the big city, and there are opportunities that those students can't get there. And I'm sure that their parents would like them to maybe come home or stay close or whatever, although not live in the basement.
Sandra, we have a fairly recent graduate of the university who did stay here, uh-huh. And she's right here. So she's going to tell you why she stayed.
Is that Haley?
Hi, everyone. My name's Haley Dubnoff, and I went to SU. I went to Newhouse. And I'm in Syracuse and really have no plans to leave. So I work at WCNY, do public relations and marketing, editor for our magazine. The reason I stayed is, you know, people say that there aren't jobs here for young people, but I really think there are. I've been blessed to have a lot of internships when I was in college. I think getting that experience and being exposed to a variety of different organizations that we have is important. So I think the internships thing is huge. And SU, I mean, I wouldn't have had those internships without SU. Very good networking. So I think it's about your appreciation of Syracuse, and I think a lot of times we're just sick of it. I know people from my high school, they're like, I'm going to the city and I am not coming back, and they're starting to come around. A lot of my friends have moved back from Boston and New York City, and they're looking for that slower lifestyle where it's not as hectic, where you don't have to take an hour to get to work, you know, you're there in 20 minutes. But I'm finding that there's a lot of good opportunities here, and being part of WCNY especially, we're growing and we're doing all kinds of new things. So,
where are you from originally?
I'm from Fayetteville.
You're local.
Mm-hmm. Went to JD, stayed in Syracuse. So all my family's here, which is another reason why I'm in Syracuse. But there's a lot of opportunities. I think people just have to find them. So,
thank you. You want to say something about coming back? We have here are two comebackers. Grew up. One new. Oh, we got a twofer. So we've got a comebacker, Elaine Walter's son, Grayson.
Hi. I was one of the folks that grew up in Syracuse and couldn't wait to get out of town. I went to law school in Nashville and then moved to Chicago for about 6 years. And we came back, my wife and I did, about 3 years ago now. Again, quality of life, decent jobs are available. Some of our predecessors have to kind of get out of the way every once in a while. So, and make room for the new up-and-comers.
There's a shrewd career move.
But no, there are certainly opportunities to be had here, and I think the area is primed for growth because we haven't seen it, and there are other areas of the country that have had it and have boom topped out and then bottomed out, and we haven't. So mm-hmm. I think we are due.
Great, thank you, Grayson. I want to say that when David Rubin was talking about the Nancy Cantor warehouse, that I couldn't help but think about University College, which, of course, was downtown for so many years until about 16, 17 years ago in Reed and Peck Halls. Now the university is back in one of those buildings. And that was, of course, the medical school before it was University College. And so my parting thought is maybe at the very least, when we think about the university in the community, we can think about do no harm. Let's just do no harm to start with, and then take it from there, and we'll be good. I want to thank our panelists, Tara Ross, David Rubin, Bob Green, Lisa Dolak, and we will look forward to hearing your regular Ivory Tower shtick tomorrow night, Friday night, on WCNY. Thanks again.
Thank you.